Perfect.
Yeah.
Couldn't you just perfect?
But gentlemen, as we said earlier, we're here to capture the history of the wetlands for future generations. We don't have any kind of political agenda. We're just here to make sure that this information is passed from one generation to the next. And Roy, whenever you're ready, we'll just give us the green light. What I thought we'd do is begin to focus on a couple of areas. One of them is the history of the family business, from its origins to your involvement. But perhaps before we get involved with that, one of the things I would like for you to talk about is the company's reforestation efforts. And I think it was the late 40s, early 50s.
It was soon after my father came back to Louisiana after the war in 1945, and I would guess that the I was been trying to remember the name of the gentleman at the professor at LSU.
You were involved
Mr. Gooch,
with the, Mr. Gooch was at Lafayette, then SLI.
Okay, and that was Mr. Gooch that I remember meeting. Mm-hmm. And it first started out that there'd been no effort to reforest Cypress as far as we knew. And we knew that we were cutting out the final second growth of our stuff up in Choctaw. And so my father decided to see if there was a way we could reforest Cypress. And we certainly had plenty of land that was of very little value except for minerals because of that. And so they worked with LSU, who were extremely supportive, I think is the best way to put it. And there's some pictures out there in the hall that you've seen where we're growing the seedlings, and they're all grown on dry land. And then the idea was then to transplant them.
Right.
And I remember one vacation when I came back from school, my job was to go out and plant cypress in the swamp. And when you do that, I did that for about 10 days. And it's literally bending over, digging a hole into the swamp. In other words, every time you get the dirt out or some mud out, mud would fall into the hole. It was very frustrating. But we got it in, and then we started to do some economics about what it would cost and how long it would take to for harvest the trees. And as I remember, it was 85 years before you would get a piling or telephone pole. I don't know which of the two of those are larger, but the larger of the two. And it was 115 years to get an 18-inch saw log. That's a tree that would be 18 inches in diameter at waist height, which is about where you cut it. And the economics of $1,000 an acre, which is what it cost in 1950, there was just no way that it was going to work over 115 years. Discount that back, and as I said to you earlier today, even at advanced price of gold, it's probably pretty similar, right?
Yeah. Didn't make any economic sense, and the critters really kind of made it impossible, because the same problem you're dealing with now up in Lake Maurepas with that, I guess, Turtle Point or Turtle Pond area, they'd eat the seedlings long before they could grow to a size to be immune from being consumed by the critters. So the combination of the two made it just uneconomically viable, and they found that natural regeneration from the stumps basically worked just as well. Mm-hmm.
And that's once every 26 years. Yeah. What I remember my father told me, the water conditions, not coming out of stumps, but for actual seedlings to take place and to grow so it would get up high enough so the water wouldn't drown them, was every 26 years Cypress naturally forested itself. Yeah. Now, interesting aside, he's talking about the critters. I assume you're talking about Nutria.
Right.
We've got a letter here someplace. Maybe you saw it in the files. To my father and Mrs. McElhenney, down at Avery Island, wanted to buy some nutria. And this must make the women's livers very happy, because the female nutria was worth about four times what the male nutria was worth. So that's one of those critters. But you know, the McElhenneys brought them over here, and they just spread like wildfire. And you figure that it was a nutria problem on Cyprus in the 50s, and they didn't bring them over until, I think, either just before or just after the war.
What was the loss, the ratio? Do you have any idea? You're talking about a loss to critters. I mean, were you talking about half the trees? Or
I really don't know, but it was substantial, because it's such a slow-growth tree that just... The elements and the environment just didn't allow it to grow fast enough to be, you know, to be destroyed, you know, naturally. And so you're starting to talk about putting in $1,000 into an acre, and maybe 50% survive. It makes it next to near impossible to reforest it. And then you throw into account the change in hydrology that took place in the 20th century. And that certainly affected growth rates too. Mm-hmm. So it's become, you know, it's pretty difficult, you know, from an economic point of view, to reforest Cyprus.
Okay. Well, could you talk a little bit more about the changes in hydrology and its impact?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest thing, of course, would be the levying of the Mississippi River. Started to affect the flooding of the river system and all of its tributaries. And that, of course, you know, because Cyprus is supposed to have, you know, essentially 6 months dry, 6 months wet. And no longer, that pattern was disrupted by the levying of the river, by the construction of other levees, by the construction of canal systems and those type of things. And all of that changed the natural hydrology to where you could have areas of the swamp which were never dry anymore, and it just slowed growth rate down tremendously. So, reforestation project today, I think, is next to near impossible, unless it would be some type of government-funded project, like a diversion project or something, where you kind of had unlimited funds to make it happen because it was something you wanted to do. But from an economic logging point of view, it makes no economic sense at all.
I had a quick question for you. When does Cyprus, we talked about the age of the trees that you expected to harvest in the 21st century. How old does a tree have to be before it begins to take on those desirable properties, you know, that make it damp, resistant to dampness and moisture and rotting?
I have no clue, but I've just got to assume that most of those characteristics are there from the very beginning. But, you know, just like, you know, I would assume that as it gets older, it gets tougher, because it survived. I don't know. What do you think, Greg?
I would tend to agree with you. I think it's to the point, it's to the point where really it can't be destroyed by outside elements, and that's mostly going to be, you know, the animals of the swamp. Mm-hmm. To where it get to a decent size, and I think then it's just gonna grow and grow and continue to grow, you know, until it becomes merchantable timber. And you see that in the swamp. You'll see small trees, and once they're kind of, you know, maybe our height, then they're gonna continue to grow unless something happens. They're struck by lightning or a tree falls on them, or you know, at that point the critters can't get to them. So I probably, without not having a scientific answer, I would say from day one.
You know, one interesting thing about which I just was thinking about when you guys started coming here, was out there, there are about five cypress trees that my father planted, right at the base of the levee. And those are certainly merchantable size right now. So those trees have only been there for 50 years. So there's a real question in my mind as to whether the swamp was the real best place, wet, all the time wet, whether it could really grow that way, or they were better off at least half dry land, like the way it used to be, and half wet. But we've got a lot of, not a lot, but a number of cypress trees around this park that I remember planting, you know, having been, or, and they're certainly merchantable size now.
After 50 years, more or less. After 50 years, more or less.
Well, maybe about 60 or 70, but I mean, they're certainly more than just the piling size, but they weren't, they've spread out more as far as their foliage goes because they haven't been in a dense group to see grow up. It's just like the redwood forest and everything else. What's kept them growing up was that there's no sun coming in. They've got to go up for it.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, what got your family involved in the cypress industry to begin with?
Well, this is all from folklore, but my great-grandfather came over to the United States from Ireland in the 1860s, and then went to Chicago and went to work for a box company, and eventually ended up owning the box company. And of course, boxes come from wood, so he started going into the lumber business in the Midwest. Back at the Paul Bunyan days, and eventually they cut out, and there was a number of them there. Weyerhaeuser was one of them. There were three or four other families that either came south or went west because they had cut out of timber in the Midwest.
Well, when you're talking about the logging industry at that time, I know many of the companies that came here were involved in logging in Michigan. Was your family?
Well, Michigan, it was all over that area. I mean, he was headquartered in Chicago and it was in Michigan or whatever. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those families came here, but a great number of them went out to the West Coast. That's how they got out there. They were after the trees.
Right.
And so he ended up and came down here. And from what I understand, he had some partners, and the first attempt went broke. And then he came down on his own in 1889 and started our company. And the mill was about 300 yards from here on the what's now the Harvey Canal, or is the Harvey Canal. And the Harvey Canal was dug, it was originally just a drainage ditch. And it was deepened and widened by Captain Harvey, who was married to Miss Destrehan, because this is the Destrehan plantation. And the canal was paid for by a tithe on our logs. And so it became a, you know, there's pictures in the 1880s and 90s where, I mean, it was a legitimate canal. I mean, it was not just a, I mean, the drainage, it wasn't just a drainage ditch. And from here we were cutting in LaForce Parish, St. Charles, St. James, where else, Greg?
Jefferson, south of here.
Yeah. And it was all the, from what I understand, and you tell me where I'm wrong on this, it from the time they decided to cut a tract of land, it was a year before they ever got the logs to the mill. Because what they would have to do was they'd have to girdle the log so the sap would come out. Because the cypress, especially the lower parts of the tree, was so heavy that it would sink. And so they had to let some of the sap drain out. And so they go into the swamp and girdle a log, and then you got to remember in the swamp in the summer, between the hornets, the mosquitoes, and all the other things, it was just a very, very unpleasant. You couldn't work in the summer. Isn't that about the way I understood it?
Yeah. You girdle them in the winter, and you'd come back the following winter, cut them, and float them out. Because working in the summer, well, I mean, you guys have been in the swamp, but you know what it's like there in the summer. If you see some of those pictures on those walls with those old rubberized waders and how they had to work, you wonder how they did it.
Oh. And then you see, if you take a look at this map, from Lake Des Almond, where all the stuff in LaFourche Parish would be cut here, and then basically a lot of it was done by Bragland, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Dragged to Lake Des Almond, and then we had the boats that were then taking Lake Des Almond, Bayou Des Almond, to Lake Salvador, and then Lake Salvador into the Harvey Canal, or Lake into Barrie Barataria, and then come up here
into the mill.
Up here to the canal and then come up.
Now, these were towboats, pull boats?
They were...
They since the logs were now floating,
right.
they would chain them together. I've actually got some old pieces of lumber that have the bore hole in it where they peg them together, and they'd just float them. They'd pull them.
Were these large like steamboats, or were they smaller? Sometimes they're called gas boats.
I think they were both. I think getting them in and out of the swamp, were smaller boats. And then they became larger boats as they started maneuvering, into the lake. And you've got, I think, one of the certificates for one of the larger boats hanging on the wall there. And if you look on the wall over here, I think you've got a couple of pictures of some of the smaller boats actually working in the canal. So I think it was a combination of both, the smaller boats to get them out of the swamp into the larger bodies of water, and then larger boats to push them up into the Harvey Canal.
We've seen pictures of individuals standing with pikes on the raft to help maneuver them. Do you remember anything like that, to get the rafts of logs around bends?
Well, I mean, it was quite a sight to when you go down a canal. We had a mill at Choctaw, which I used to go to shoot snakes, because they'd be on these flows of logs. And so I'd go there with my little 22 and have a good time. I mean, you'd get flows of logs that'd be, as you can see from those pictures, hundreds of yards long. Hmm. And they would be, when they decided to cut an area, they'd put a levee around it with huge pumps that would then put water into the specified area. The logs would be cut. The trees would be cut into logs, and manhandled over to the levee at the side, then pulled over the levee into the canal, and then it would be with these metal boats we had, would then bring them to the mill.
You had two mills, one in Choctaw, and then your main mill was here in, let's call it Harvey.
Correct.
Okay.
And then we had a joint mill in Ponchatoula with Williams.
All right. So let me get this.
Is it a joint mill?
I thought we had a joint mill with them.
I don't think so.
They had their mill, we had ours?
They had their mill, we had our mill. I'm almost positive that's the case.
So,
And the mill here ceased to operate when we cut out in the southern part, to the, shall we say, the south of the river.
Okay. About what time frame are we talking about here when the mill shut down?
1915, something like that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. 1910. And went up to Livingston Township, Ahoa Parishes, and at the mill in Ponchatoula.
Mm-hmm. Now that mill was drawing lumber primarily from the Manchac area, or was it closer to Ponchatoula on the streams out there?
Well, both. If you look at the map, and we don't have one here, but somewhere we have another map, we go basically from I-55... all the way across and encompass both the Tickfaw and then the Tolbany River, and go all the way from the lake all the way to basically dry ground.
22, Highway 22.
Yes, so basically Highway 22. So, on the I guess the northeastern edge would be Ponchatoula, and that would be the northeastern edge of our property. When you get off the interstate at the Ponchatoula, the first Ponchatoula exit off of I-55, that's kind of the northern boundary there of our property, with I-55 being the eastern boundary. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So 14,000 acres, more or less.
And Williams, you see, had, what we did was we'd have a layer of, let's say, three or four sections going across, going east to west, And then Williams would have the next layer section deep, and then we'd have a layer. And
you would call it a checkerboarding. And then we worked it together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've been talking to the Williams people through the Historic New Orleans collection, which was started by the Williams family. Mm-hmm. We have a pretty good understanding of their mill at Patterson, but I'm intrigued by something that you pointed out. You're harvesting timber essentially, for just sake of discussion, west of Lac des Allens, and you're moving it by water. That's a long ways to pull timber. And I think that's critical to the story, because we sometimes think you cut timber and right there is the mill.
Yeah.
You don't realize that you may be moving it, I would guess if I looked at that, maybe 100 miles to a mill site, which is, for those of you growing up in the industry, that's the way it's done. But remember, we're going to be looking at people who may be children now that have to understand that was a long ways to pull timber.
Yeah.
So, that's a fascinating part of the story, because there's all kinds of critical issues when you move by water.
Yeah.
Yeah. So don't assume any knowledge when you're telling these stories.
It was a long haul. I've forgotten, it was way over a year from when we first started to work on a log till we got it to the mill, and I don't know how long it took. From, let's say, from the time a log was cut until it even got to Lake Salvador or Lake des Allens.
Yeah.
How many?
Well, it's not. It seems like a long way, but as the crow flies, you're probably only talking 30 to 40 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Be out there in a minute.
Right, but nothing in this area, where, especially when you're going by water, nothing's ever as the crow flies.
True, true.
And you're using technology that's not even close to what we see today.
No, that's absolutely right.
And it's just, it's.
Yeah, but I always like to think, we think about how did the pyramids get built and those kind of things. So these guys they just made it happen, I think in a lot of respects, they were stronger and more determined than we are today.
Do you have any idea, just as a general rule of thumb, how many board feet you could expect to get from a mature log?
I have no clue. Well, a mature log, depending on, some of those logs were 4 feet diameter.
We kept extensive records with each quarter section. And what was pulled out of it, and the estimated board feet, and just extensive records. Old binders. Unfortunately, we had them you'd think you'd lost your mind, but we had them in a subterranean vault downtown, and they were flooded. Yeah. Now, we've had them restored, but I'm not sure that they're in nearly the quality that they were in prior to being flooded.
I want to encourage you guys to either have them microfilmed or
digitized. We did. They've all been photographed, but unfortunately it's in the recovered stage as opposed to the original stage.
Well, Greg, what are those, all the stuff that I microfilmed?
Michael, a microfilm?
Yeah, 20 years ago.
Yeah, that wasn't those old books, I don't believe. Those were old maps and records.
It was title.
Title stuff, okay. Mostly title stuff.
Well, I'm a colonial historian, and my real interest is seeing what the landscape looked like originally.
Yeah.
And so that's a gold mine of information.
Well, as bad as those records have been restored, as poorly as they've been restored, it was all done by that freeze-dried method,
right.
And we had it done up in Rochester, New York, I think, for cost $80,000.
Well, that's state-of-the-art. That's the best technique available, right?
So, you're welcome to look at those if you ever want to.
Well, thank you.
Well, before you, I know you have another meeting.
And I can come back in here. Okay.
I want to ask, Carl and I are intrigued by something. Did your company ever build purposely the sides of boxes? I mean, you got it. I'm going to give you a real example.
Okay.
The Texas company. Come to you and said, we want you in your mill to create for us the sides of boxes. Can you ever remember the Rathburn family being involved in producing the site? I'm going somewhere, and you'll see okay. in a moment. The
but signs you, you of You need boxes. To address that to him.
All right. Before Do you my ever time, remember but... that happening? No. All right.
Oh. They used to create boxes that held
two five-gallon tins of kerosene.
And these were shipped all over the world. And one mill alone in the southeast Texas employed about 1,000 employees.
Huh. Just doing that.
Just doing that.
And the reason I ask, apparently the Texas company had what is called a shook. Shook are simply box sizes or the barrel staves. And if you start thinking, well, this is a major, evolved into a major oil company. Yeah. That is a lot of Cyprus that ended up in China, in Japan, Middle America, Brazil.
But they also employed Louisiana mills, which is why we're asking. Mm-hmm. Because
did you find anything when you looked through all the old correspondence or anything? That correspondence is pretty thorough in terms of what was going on right here in Harvey.
Right. We didn't see anything.
No.
We wanted to cover
all East Texas, you know, was a huge lumber business. That's where the money was made in Texas before oil, was lumber. East Texas was huge lumber. I mean, a lot of it pine, but there was a lot of cypress there, too.
Well, the Stark family, Diver Stark and Brown was a very large cypress company in Donner. The Lutcher family were married into the Stark family after Lutcher. They own some things in the Maurepaw, so there's these connections that I don't, it depends if...
Well, Lutcher Moore property was just all sold.
It did not go to...
The state.
It went to the Nature Conservancy.
Turned it over to the state. It was sold to the state.
And it was XLO, XLO Oil Company. There's an oil company involved, and it also
I think way back when, Mecham owned it. John Mecham owned it, I think.
And didn't it go through the Gray family? The Gray family somewhere's... I don't know. I don't know how big their footprint is, but I know, of course...
I don't think they got this far east, I don't think.
But if you're in Texas, of course, you talk about pine to cypress. If you're in Louisiana, we talk cypress to pine.
Yeah.
But the family connections, sometimes convoluted, are still there because, again, East Texas was such an important pine-producing region. We have some superb photography of the log jams coming down the Sabine, going to mills in the southern part of Texas and Lake Charles.
Yeah, that was... That's where real money was made in Houston, was from the lumber family. Before the oil was discovered. Now, a lot of those guys had a lot of oil on their land.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it happened to us, too, in a lot of respects. Guys, I need to go meet with this gentleman for a couple of minutes, and I can come back in.
Keep track of
the questions you want to ask me, and I'll be more than happy to answer them. I'll be right back.
Thanks, Greg.
He said he didn't need to come here because he didn't know much. Well, he knew a lot more than he thinks he did.
That's always the case.
He lives out there. He lives in Boutte. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he's right out in the middle of it.
How did your family business survive the Depression?
Well, we got lucky, I think. We cut out in 1926. And I think my grandfather died about that, great-grandfather died about that stage in the game. So we went into the Depression with all cash and no debt. And we paid for the property taxes for three ways they would. Trapping, railroad ties. Mm-hmm. People come in, let them cut ties out of some of the remaining trees. And the third was moss, because moss was used for mattresses. That was the low-end mattress was made out of moss, and the high-end was made out of horsehair. So that's what saved us during the Depression. And then my father, when my aunt turned 21, her part of the estate became hers, and so then she and my father recapitalized the company and came down here in the late 30s to try to build Harvey up primarily to as a center for the oil industry. And then went from there. I mean, my father then had a mill up in Roseland, Pine Mill, Roseland, Louisiana. And we had a planing mill and stuff here, but that wasn't successful. So we got out of that. And it's just been primarily a real estate company ever since.
Mm-hmm. Well, the mill that was here, was it producing simply planks or shingles or, I mean, the whole gamut?
I think it was primarily, from what pictures I've seen, it's just primarily lumber.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, since your family was instrumental in many ways of developing the industrial corridor along Harvey Canal, right across on the other side of the canal is a place called Southern Seafood.
Mm-hmm.
Was your family involved ever in the seafood business or in the processing of seafood?
Not that I know of, okay. And I would doubt it.
Okay, but you did talk about your connection with trapping, the trapping industry.
Right.
Could you explain a little bit about how that worked?
Well, now this is just from what my memory of it is, because I used to go down every year. There'd be an auction, and all the trappers would come to one place, and then the northern buyers would come down, and they would basically buy the pelts, and we got a royalty or a percentage of the of whatever trapper trapped for using our property, and I forgot what the percentage was, but it was quite a sight to see these guys. I mean, these guys, you know, had been out in the swamp for, I mean, these were true trappers, and I lived out there.
Now, that when they went out there, did they take their families?
Well, I mean, I just know that by history, by reading about it. I never saw it.
Mm-hmm.
The auction was kind of a happy day because, I mean, the families would come. It was probably the only cash they saw all year. Or I don't know how many auctions there were. There must have been more than one a year. But then I don't know if there was any, trapping was any good in the summer, if the pelts were any good in the summer.
About how many people are we talking about would collect for these auctions?
As I remember, you'd see over 100 people there. And it wouldn't be just our property. I mean, it would be from all over. You know, I went to them twice when I was a young kid, but I mean, I still remember them. I mean, they were really quite a, it was really quite something to see. And a nice bunch of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that on your property in the Maurepas, because you were logging by train, that often the trappers would hitch a ride on the train and go into the swamp.
Why not?
Yeah, but it's an interesting story that it was just this two industries that worked together. So yeah. You would go in and you would allow the trappers to get on your train and go into the swamp, and I assume they would trap for the day or whatever, come out and get a train ride back. And that's a very nice story.
Well, you know, there's a little bit of enlightened self-interest there, too, because it kept other people out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, so they were our watchmen.
Okay, that's fair. Sure.
You know, because if you know the guys that are in there, they're not going to take advantage, or they won't let the other guys take advantage. So I mean, it's self-policing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, did your family ever get involved in like when you become a real estate company, taking some of your property and turn it into like subdivisions or anything like that?
We've done a lot of that.
Really.
But not so much of our own property, but property we've bought. But now, for instance, where Greg lives, which is right in here, this is our property, and that's called Willow Ridge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is Willowdale here, where there's a golf course. And this is Willow Ridge in here, and and Greg lives in, Greg developed that property. He was in charge of that and did it. And he lives there now.
Okay. All right.
And You know, this is in one way, a real a snapshot of Louisiana as far as developing what was, quote, wetlands.
Okay.
We had a run-in with the Corps and had a settlement whereby we could only have this piece of property, could only develop so much of it. And so we developed a few hundred acres. And then we had the last, about 80 acres left that we thought we wanted to develop. And we're just not going to be able to do it. And there is a tremendous pressure to allow no expansion of the wetland. And I don't know that it makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, there's certain areas that clearly should not be developed. And it's pretty obvious by looking at a map or looking at the property, but the Corps and the conservancy groups got to the point where there's no give whatsoever. And I think that hurts them in the long haul, because there's some areas that could be the good to everybody's benefit. I mean, for drainage and everything else, but the lines have been drawn now, and there's no give. So we then just bought with our partners some property here on the Mississippi River, and I've been developing that, which is called Ashton Plantation, which is all cane land.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no environmental problems with that. We're that's the only developments that we've
mm-hmm.
done.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had talked. In your knowledge, this area looks like a land reclamation project. This area looks like a potential land reclamation.
Well, that's all marsh. You won't be able to do anything there.
This one here looks like it might have at one time been a land reclamation project. Then there's some place over here that we've read called New Netherlands, that we're not sure where it is. But it looks like there's a series of areas here, some of which may have been owned by Carlos Marcelo.
Well, this is Marcellus tract. This levee here was built by the first basic levee district.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all Marcellus property, or was originally Marcellus property, all the way to here.
Okay.
And this is now part of Avondale. But the Marcellus still owns, I've forgotten how many thousand acres this is.
All right.
But the Marcellus still own a few thousand acres in there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where Jedco has put their, this map is so old. This map is 1972. But in here is where Jedco has put its industrial park, or office park, I guess is a better way of putting it. And this is slowly being developed, but every time they've tried to do something in there, housing-wise, they found it just pretty impossible, because there's an area that if you dig 2 feet, you get 4 feet of water. I'm saying that as an exaggeration, but...
Now, are these two tracts here reclaimed? I mean, this is the Harvey Canal. So we have on the, again, we'll say the west side, a large tract between the La Rose Lafitte, I guess that's highway, because it does have characteristics that may be reclaimed.
So this is what's the name of that subdivision? There's a big subdivision in here.
Okay.
Comes down here. Now this tract is right along the canal. It's maybe goes out 1,000 feet. That's still wet. That's owned by Marjorie Shushin and people that own the salvage company. I'll think of that in a second. But a lot of this is developed.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it isn't. Also, a lot of Marrero owns a fair amount of property in here. There's a...
That's the Marrero Land Company?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this looks, just by looking at the photograph, that looks wet. I mean, like it's marsh instead of swamp.
Mm-hmm. Well, since your family's had such a visual presence from Harvey all the way over here to Lac des Almonds and, what is it, Grand Bayou, in your lifetime, what environmental changes have you seen, or what just general changes have you seen?
In broad strokes.
We've clearly seen... Well, the oil companies have been blamed for an awful lot of the problem to the marsh. The species of the marsh, rather than differentiate the marsh from the swamp. But it's interesting, we have a timber cruise in 1903 of the south, down in the south down here, of a tract of timber that we wanted to buy. And the guy giving the cruise says it was the Bayou DuPont is where it was. Said, don't buy it because the saltwater intrusion has killed the trees, or is killing it. Now, this is way before the oil companies, way before all the navigation canals. This is just nature.
1903.
That's timber. You remember that timber cruise? That,
yep.
Said, the land, the timber's no good. And it said it will die. It's dying off now, but it's all been contaminated by salt water. So you can say that man has done a lot of this. Nature's doing it. And if you look at the four different mouths of the river, starting over
3,000 B.C.
Yeah, I mean, the present river is only from 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so these three other deltas, which is the one that was St. Martinville?
Sycamore?
No, what's the
Bayou Sally?
Bayou Teche. Yeah. Bayou Teche was originally part of the river. Then La Fourche was the river. And then... to the east, down Moropov, and that. So this is the fourth time we've had the river, so we were going to lose this stuff anyway. That doesn't mean you got to go out and rape it. But this stuff is going.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not being replenished. That's what the real problem is. Well, yeah.
And we're stopping the replenishment with the levees on the river and everything else. I mean, there's a famous family story about... I think it was during the 1927 flood that they were going to, the Corps of Engineers or the city or whatever were going to blow up the levees below the city to relieve the pressure. And the trappers down there said, "To heck with that! You're going to ruin us, put us out of business. There's nothing in Harvey. Let's go blow it there." And they were going to do it. So my grandfather went out and bought a case of Winchesters and had all the employees along the river. And at night she said, "Shoot anybody you see except for people. My daughter and I will be in a white robe and we'll bring you coffee and food." And that went on for a week. So, I mean, you know, things were not...
Well, there's a... You had mentioned to Carl and I casually, one of the things we're interested in is certainly the labor force, and it had to be significant labor force. And there's no indication that your family ever used tokens or script or anything like that. It was always sort of a cash business to the employees. Well, this very cup over here shows that the employees had a great deal of respect for the family. Now, I don't know that that's universal, but that's an important thing. If you would please comment on it, because
I can tell you this is not commonplace in early 20th century America.
Well, he was well liked. But he was a good guy. And he'd been through his own personal problems, and it licked him. But there was one time when we did have script, and I think it was in the 1908 Depression. And we had a cash bind, and Mr. Fytel, and I remember Fytel's store, so I remember this, was on just on the other side of the canal, and he took the company script, or took grandfather's IOUs, basically, and fed everybody that were here at the mill. It didn't, you know, that didn't last for more than about a year, but I mean, there was a time when times were tough, and we did have script, and everybody willingly, they had a choice. They could quit, they could go where, because there was no place to go, or at least they could be fed.
Right, but the situation Don is talking about is one that stretched over decades.
Yes, you know? It wasn't. Yeah. That was a courtesy to the employees, and that's also quite rare in early industrial history. It's just a very good story.
He was, from everything I know, he was he was a bachelor from 1880 something, and never remarried. And from everything I understood, he was a well-liked person.
Well, clearly it carries over to the current generation, because you certainly welcomed us.
Yeah. Well, and this is a pretty amazing company, because almost no one leaves here. I have been here 25 years. Our secretary, mineral lady, has been here 30 years. We've had two property managers retire, both with over 25 years of service. Nobody leaves.
It's quite a testament.
Nobody leaves. Our president before Cokie had been here over 30 years. That's a pretty good testament of what's going on here.
Yes, it is.
Well, Joe Boudreau and his father both worked here, and between them they had 80 years. So, anyway, they're nice guys, too.
Greg, are you native Louisianian?
Yes, I was born and raised in New Orleans, lived here all my life.
Where'd you get your education?
I went to Ecole Classique High School in New Orleans, and then went to Southeastern for my undergraduate, and then Loyola Law School.
I taught at Nichols, so I was hoping maybe we had a little Nichols connection
there. Well, I was a city boy for forever, and so I ended up going to Southeastern up in Hammond, and then didn't move out to Luling until I came to work here, and they wanted a presence, because we had all these things going on in St. Charles Parish. They wanted a presence out in St. Charles Parish, so I moved there in, I think, 1987.
And he's become quite a presence here, too, by the way.
Well, before you came in, we'd ask Cokie, and maybe you can comment. When you think of your, I'm not going to say land holdings, but interests, it goes from the west side of Lake Des Almonds along Grand Bayou, where there's some really nice camp clusters, and it extends essentially the Harvey Canal, and crossing that is the Louisiana Cypress Lumber Company Canal. All right, you grew up in New Orleans, but you can look at this map and visualize change. Can you just comment, change?
I mean, Cokie just mentioned this was the 1972 map, so if you just take a quick glance at the map and tell us in broad strokes,
an amazing map. I'm a map lover, so I read maps. I'm pretty good at reading maps. I love aerial photography, so this is, I can't tell you how many times I've sat in this conference room and started pointing out things. Sometimes you got to be a local to understand it all, but if you just talk about, if you start over here in the city, I always look at this and say, this part in and of itself is amazing, because you go out to New Orleans East and there's basically nothing there at that point in time. Now you've got the development of New Orleans East. As you come up into here, one of the things that jumps out at you right off the bat is in this area right here, there's no Superdome. There's no downtown New Orleans skyline. You got old Tulane Stadium.
as you get up in here, it really becomes interesting because this is all the lakefront in memory. There's the causeway. You can see all this land that doesn't have any houses on it. That's all built now. You look at this. This is Elmwood.
And we ended up buying
it. You know, this is Elmwood in 1972. And this is Elmwood in 1990. Same track of land. You can see what's there now. This is even more developed because now the Coca-Cola plant is right there.
And we sold that to Coke.
This has all been developed. So this is even, I mean, this is even more developed than it shows right there.
Not to interrupt, but my three favorite roads in Louisiana are there.
Okay.
Yeah. Hickory.
Hickory.
Dickory.
Hickory and Dock. Yep.
Somebody had a great sense of humor.
Yep. The, you know, if you come over to the West Bank and you start looking at what's been developed here, it's pretty amazing because, you know, this whole area has become residential subdivisions. English Turn is down over here. There's, you know, just been quite a bit of development. And as you kind of start heading west, you know, we've built a huge subdivision kind of right in here that's been developed. And all of this in here was turned into Ormond. The Ormond subdivision, huge subdivision. Most of this in this area has been developed now. None of this has been developed in here. So it's just, it's all kind of grown up as you go. If you had a more modern map, you'd see that a lot of this has eroded and subsided. And so the nature of this is going to have changed quite a bit also, because of what's going on with our coast.
Greg, they asked me a question on the Marcella Tract.
Yes,
I said this was all part from, this is the first levee district built this levee around here. And I'm pretty sure the first basin levee district.
May have.
But that part of that's developed now.
Yeah. So it's changed dramatically
in
35 years or so.
A visual reference. Where's La Palco?
La Palco, basically, the green line right here.
Okay.
This is La Palco.
All right.
And that comes back up around and then kind of ties in, you know, up in here.
Okay.
Kind of comes through probably right there. Follow, you know, La Palco is Louisiana Power and Light Company. That's what it stands for. And so it follows the power line, and you can see the power line, and that power line just turns and just comes in right there past the bridge circle there.
We'd like for you to continue, but do you know, in your knowledge, either one of you, do you know the name Amesville? Have either one of you heard the term Amesville?
Obviously know Ames Boulevard, but not Amesville.
That's important. Yeah. You know Ames Boulevard. Well, Amesville, nearest as Carl and I can figure, is right up there a little bit, upriver.
That would make sense.
And it was the offloading point for Texaco.
Huh. It was a big facility.
It was Texaco's first major presence in Louisiana as a distribution company.
Sure.
And it's, if you look at the old maps, and I know you have some interest, you'll find a little town of Amesville.
Okay.
On the river.
What facility did they have there?
They had tanks for storing oil because they were very active in that period.
Okay, I'll tell you exactly where it was.
All right.
Because great-grandfather, we had a choice. When he came down here, was to put a mill
here
on the Harvey Canal, or one where Bayou Sinette comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a, where the heck is that?
Right
in here. This is where there was a plantation here called Seven Oaks or Nine Oaks or something like that. And it was owned by Texaco. And all around it were those tanks that are there now. Remember where that plantation used to be?
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful place. Mm-hmm. And I'll bet you that's where it was.
Okay.
So it was right where the road, where the river road kind of comes around, basically parallels the river, and then goes, where's the bridge? Yeah, it comes like this, and then when it goes like that, goes straight across, That's where, well, you can see the tanks here now that were all part of this. I'll bet you that's where it was.
Well, Ames Boulevard.
Yeah.
Because Texaco owned that plantation, we'll get back to it. And great-grandfather was deciding whether to buy that to live and use, in effect, buy a Sonette as a means to, of transportation, or the Harvey Canal. So that,
yeah, that's interesting. Greg, go ahead and continue, because it's fascinating.
Well, it's, you know, you come up into, you know, we talked about Destrehan, you really can't see it up into Laplace, but because it goes off the map, but you've got that whole development of the Laplace area, Belterre, mm-hmm. and all the subdivisions mm-hmm. around Belterre, that would all be up in there. And then you start getting out this way and not as much development. Mm-hmm. You know, it's still kind of, you know, Edgard, you look at that map 35 years later, that hasn't changed a lot. And you look
and
at
that's
this.
That's where the bridge is there,
yeah,
right?
A
there.
Lot of this, well, no, the bridge is actually here in Gramercy.
Oh,
and you look at this, and you still got the little developments along the thing, the old sugarcane farms. That really hasn't changed all that much.
Okay, well, let's look at the area below that 80 Arpent line, Greg, and talk about the environmental and developmental changes that have taken place.
Well, you know, this whole area is suffering from the same problems that we see. You've got subsidence issues. You have saltwater intrusion issues, and so. You're just seeing, you know, you're seeing a change in what has happened. You can look over here in this old map. This is basically this area here, the Lulin area. You can just look at some areas in here that just aren't as healthy as they once were because of what's going on with subsidence and saltwater intrusion and those type of things.
And no flooding from the river.
And so, you know, you're in all that, you're seeing those things. I mean, they're still stable and they're still there, but they're degrading. They're not improving. You couple that with the water lilies and the salvinia and the nutria and, you know, that whole area, that this whole area has those issues.
Now, were you involved in a donation for the Salvador Wildlife Refuge?
No.
No, okay.
That was before my time.
I think that one of the things we'd like for you to discuss is that maybe the three of us have studied the wetlands. We don't live it as a manager.
Okay. Well, yes, but studying it is different from really knowing it, yeah. If you know what I mean, having daily hands-on yeah. experience.
So when you look at any tract of land, you're going to see it a bit different than those of us from a science mm-hmm. background, because you have to manage that land.
Right.
So when you start thinking of management in your tenure, and then management in the next 25 years, or perhaps 50 years, can you just comment just how you've observed things, how you go about, I mean, this is a large amount of land.
Yeah. Well, I guess you look at management from two or three different points of view. The first one is trying to generate some income off the land, if nothing else, than to pay for taxes and insurance. And so what we have done is we have proactively decided that we want to have all of our property leased for some type of outdoor recreation type activity, whether it's hunting, fishing, whatever. And so most of our land is leased. A lot of it's been leased to the same hunting club for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and there's some very good reasons for that.
It's very, very low prices just to keep them.
Very low prices. Very good reasons for that, though, because you need to have, they're possessing that land for you, so they're validating your title, but they're also keeping the poachers off and the trespassers off, for the most part, they've got sound game management practices so that they're improving their deer herds. That's about all we really hunt. I wish we had more duck land, but we don't because I'm a duck hunter. So that's kind of the first level of management in terms of making sure that we have tenants on the land protecting our interests, because there's no way We run a very small shop over here. There's no way that we can keep an eye on 50,000 acres. It's impossible. The second part of the
management...
Okay. You know, the second part of management comes in with, you know, how can we, you know, improve the land? And that, at times, becomes difficult. Any type of wetland improvement project, to use that word, is sometimes difficult to get approved and expensive to implement. We spent quite a bit of money trying to develop a project to introduce fresh water into our property in Lake Maurepas, and we just really ran into a substantial amount of resistance from DNR and the Corps of Engineers, you know, trying to get them to buy into this project as a project that would improve the marsh. And all we wanted to do was get enough mitigation credits so that we could pay for the project, and we couldn't get past that point. We've looked at, you know, other types of projects, you know, to try to kind of, you know, improve things where we see issues, because you have right now you have a serious, and I'd be interested if you talked about that Turtle Pond or Turtle Cove project. I'm going to be interested to see what happens, because you have serious saltwater intrusion issues on the north shore of Lake Maurepas. You wouldn't think that you do, but you most definitely do have serious saltwater intrusion issues, and there's got to be a way to get more fresh water into that system, or that whole ecosystem is going to change for the worse. Mm-hmm.
But what Greg wanted to do, which I still don't understand why they stopped us, there's a canal at the just south of Ponchatoula.
Yeah.
That is just it brings it over to, in effect,
and it takes all the drainage out of the whole Ponchatoula watershed,
mm-hmm.
and kind of runs it down this canal. What I wanted to do was divert that and run it through the swamp.
Yeah. But the canal basically dumps it onto the canal going along I-55,
right.
which is ours.
Yeah.
And so they wouldn't let the water go through, which to me was just stupid.
How long ago?
We worked on this for probably 3 years, and I'd say starting point was probably, you know, beginning 2000, 2001, something in that age. So finally, you know, you spend $75,000 or $100,000, and you're kicking yourself in the head, and it's like, you know,
they always suspect you've got an ulterior motive.
And like I say, we basically said, look, we think this will work. We had we had Woody Gagliano helping us.
Mm-hmm.
We had the Fenster Maker environmental people mm-hmm. helping us, and mm-hmm. we got nowhere. And all we wanted was, look, we're not asking you to sign off on this project and say, yes, this is going to create, you know, all this wonderful things. Here's 1,000,000 credits to go sell. Just give me enough to pay for it. And then if we can't demonstrate that the thing works and is improving the swamp, well then, mm-hmm. you know, the old nothing ventured, nothing gained. Couldn't get to that point. A couple of things, though, that have happened that I think are going to be beneficial is we worked with Dr. Day on this wetland assimilation project in Lubling, and that has already had beneficial results to the swamp in that area. I am told the leaf litter has increased dramatically, and some very good things are happening. So we're looking at another one of those projects actually in the Maurepas area, and another one also in St. Charles Parish. So it's interesting how things turn around and change. 20 years ago, the EPA hated oxidation ponds. Now they recognize that they can be very valuable. So we'll see how those things go. So that's kind of the trying to improve the property from that. We still have occasionally oil and gas leases that we have to manage. And we also, every now and then, have an inquiry from a timber company. And we are, because of our history, we're pretty protective of what we do with the Cypress timber. We set minimum diameters on what they can cut. We don't allow any cutting for purposes of mulch. It's got to be saw timber trees only. And it's got to be, you know, it's got to be respectful of what's going on out there. There's not a lot of that, but occasionally every 4 or 5 years we'll have a timbering operation, you know, in a small area. It'll generate some revenue, but, you know, it's preserving the land and, you know.
Now, you mentioned three items.
Okay.
One was leases.
Yes.
The second was just how you manage.
Right.
Is the third one oil and gas?
Well, the third one is kind of the revenue seeking streams, mm-hmm. which were basically oil and gas and timber operations.
Right. And trapping is out of the scene entirely.
Well, there's zero value for the nutria, but the state has created a bounty on the nutria. I think it's up to $5 a tail. And we do participate in that. The storms of the previous few years have really knocked the nutria down, actually quite a bit. They're rats at the end of the day, so they will be back. Mm-hmm. But you know that's a great program that the state's implemented, and we do participate.
But it
becomes more of a sporting event now. Your guy gets out there with his 22, and he kills 20. 30 nutria, chops a tail off, leaves the carcass in a swamp for the other animals to feed. Mm-hmm. The fur is worth nothing.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you have, I'd like to just change the direction a little bit. We mentioned oil earlier, and you were talking about it. I'd like to revisit the subject, Hoki. And first of all, I'd like to talk about Rathborn's role in making Harvey a sort of a launching pad or logistical center for the development of the oil industry in this part of Louisiana. You know, it's an interesting thing that an industry as important as oil has been to Louisiana's history, economic history, is virtually absent completely from the history of the state's history books, pages of the state's history books. So we'd like for you to recall what happened here that made Harvey such an important center for the oil industry.
Well, Greg can help me on this, but I remember that what my father decided was that we had this land here. It was non-producing, no income, that's just some taxes. And so we started developing the land along the canal. What we had was, we had a drying yard for cypress, which took 2 years when it was sticked to dry. Hmm. And so we had a tract of land that was 2 blocks or 3 blocks wide.
Well, it depends on where you were, but it was either 1 or 2 blocks wide. And the reason is that that secondary road kind of stopped, and then it just became 2 blocks wide with no street in between right. it. So.
But I mean, it went from here to La Palco. It was 3 miles.
Yeah, La Palco, interestingly enough, is the 80 Arpa line, right there.
Okay. Yeah. So he had some friends with some of the oil companies, and he basically promoted this property. Now, we didn't own the canal frontage. The canal frontage was owned by the Harvey family, or the vast majority was. They sold things off. But we started to bring people down here, and it became a kind of a launching point for a lot of the stuff in this part of South Louisiana.
Well, who were some of the first companies to move into the area?
Well, Texaco was here, Standard of Cal,
Exxon was here.
Exxon was here.
McDermott was here. The Hooper family had a huge pipe operation here,
which we financed to start off with. Yeah. I mean, to show you that, I mean, this was a local family doing something, and my father basically lent him the money to start. But it was the use of our property, so if he was a success, we would get some rental from us. I mean, it was we're good for both.
And what, like everything else, you know, we always talk about, like, these big chemical plants that we have. You know, why can't we attract more satellite industry around these plants? And that sometimes just never seems to happen, but here it did. Mm-hmm. Because all of these support companies that were helping the majors with their big packages or with this, all of, you know, the supply companies and the small fabricators and this and that, they all started moving into the area. And the story goes, and this was before my time, the story goes that there were times where it might take you an hour to get from, on Peters Road, to get from La Palco to here. There was that much activity and business along the Harvey Canal. Now, of course, that's subsided some because all of these packages that were being built back in those days have grown as we've moved farther offshore. Mm-hmm. And so the canal just isn't wide enough and deep enough to get these big packages out. So a lot of that business has moved to Houma.
Okay, so initially the majors here had refitting operations for the jack upgrades?
Basically, they would have fabrication, building platforms and crew decks and crew quarters and those type of things, a ton of that. They would have pipe storage, pipe inspection, pipe cleaning, those type of operations, and then just the various supplies. You know, this winch is broken. I need somebody to rewind the motor. That, I mean, anything and everything you can think of that had to do with heavy industry.
And some of the earliest drilling was down almost directly south of here in the Barrett area?
Correct.
Area, is that correct? Correct.
That was 1944-45.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of our transition. We went from lumber to really oil and gas. Mm-hmm. With Harvey Reynolds is kind of the,
I mean, that warehouse income. Warehouse back right over there, which we now use for our own stuff that we don't rent out. That was a mud warehouse. That was for oil, for drilling mud.
Yeah, Baroid was in
mm-hmm.
there.
Yeah, Baroid was mm-hmm. in, that's right.
Yeah.
Right across the Harvey Canal, when you cross over, you make a left turn going towards
West
Town
Expressway, okay.
All right. On the right, there's a little business called TACO, T-A-K-O, Marine Services. Do you know anything about that company? There's the reason we ask the question. The Yugoslavians in Louisiana have always been called Taco by the Acadians.
Huh.
That's the only sign Carl and I have ever seen.
I don't know. I don't even notice.
Huh.
That it even uses the term, and it is quite unique, because apparently the word taco evolved out of the Yugoslavians' habit of saying hello, and it was taco se. Well, Cajuns be what Cajun it be. I got changed to taco. And we saw that. We turned around and actually took a photograph. And I was just curious, since you have business, one of the things the Harvey Canal is noted for, not only just logistic support for the oil and gas business, the seafood industry.
Yeah.
And were you, I know you weren't directly involved in seafood, but were you involved in leasing land or in the southern Louisiana Crossaway cannery, in providing them?
Our holdings up until 1986 were exclusively on this side of the canal. The other side of the canal was the Destrehan family. They divvied that up among different family members. Their company of all the family members had quite a bit of it. And so up until the time that we bought part of that company, we did not have any holdings along Destrehan Avenue. All of our holdings were along Peters Road. So we did not deal with Southern Shellfish or yep. any of those companies. We had no dealings with them until 1986, where we bought a number of tracts of land that had businesses on them. So,
well, we were intrigued by the Southern seafood.
Yeah.
You have to be careful with hyperbole.
Scrimeta, that's
yeah.
right.
They have to be careful with hyperbole, but it's often described as the largest cannery in the world. Now, I don't know if
that sounds like hyperbole to me. but I started thinking of Monterey and some places like that. But
it is interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, they did try to get, at one point, that was where the Boomtown Bell was going to be.
Hmm.
And all sorts of hell broke loose.
That just wasn't a real sound spot to put that, but anyway.
It was too close to the canal and everything, to the actual
Well, and the itself. Actual road the, traffic and everything else. It just wouldn't have worked real well.
But that was, you could tell old Louisiana was in the middle of that one.
Yes.
How about that? It said yes. Nicely?
Yes. Very well done. Yes.
One thing I want to point out, and it's just, we haven't talked about it at all, but I keep coming back to it because I'm looking right at that map, is when they did the Davis Pond Freshwater Diversion Project, they did years of study on our land, on the ridge system. And you can see you basically got, this. Well, I think this is really cool here.
Well, you can really see it.
I mean, you've got a bird foot delta here.
Right.
For all intents and purposes. And there was a big, obviously a big overflow here. There was always this theory that the Davis crevasse, which happened in the early 1900s, where the levee kind of broke and flooded, and always thought that that was the cause of this, which doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense. But during the studies, they actually did some carbon dating of the soils in here and found them to be 3,000 years old. So that's how long that ridge system had been being formed.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought that it's just a very interesting story and a kind of a validation as to how all of this happened, over now, many millenniums.
I recognize the LeVere name. Is that D.D. LeVere out of Thibodeau? Is it the LeVere family?
It's the LeVere family. I don't know if there's a D.D. LeVere or not.
Well, the Bob Becker that was here for 40 years, or left 30 years, he ran the LeVere company for the last... until last year, for 20 years, Bob.
Maybe not 20, but certainly 15.
15.
Yeah.
Part of that, if I remember right, part of that family, the gentleman was a bachelor, and he's turned a fair amount of his production into a foundation in Thibodeau. I'm not saying the whole family, but part of it is a foundation in Thibodeau to help with education and things. Sort of like the Gaines property.
Okay,
same general philosophy.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me just show you how small the world is. This Ashton and this Ridgeland or Ellington, this and this we bought with LeVere. And we're partners with LeVere.
Yeah, we're business partners and friendly competitors, so we've had a long-term relationship with that company.
Well, how about with Bowie Land Company? Because I know, again, because I've spent some time wandering the swamps out of Kramer, Bayou Buck.
And we adjoin them out.
And you've got one that says Rathburn, no trespassing, and Bowie, no trespassing. Yeah. Okay. And I can also find oil wells that says Rathburn and Bowie. So there's clearly somehow a connection.
There's a connection, but not as close of a connection as I would say we have with either LeVere or Williams. We know them. The gentleman who currently manages Bowie, I used to work with when I worked at Chevron. He used to work at Chevron and know him well, and we work well together. But there isn't that closeness that I think we have with either LeVere or Williams.
Okay.
We just really have never had really a, I guess for lack of a better word, a business relationship. Other than being adjoining landowners.
We would like to try to do something similar with Bowie and something similar with Williams. Mm-hmm. Simply because in the northern part of the basin, you have the Wilbur family and the Schwing family. Mm-hmm. We think we can do something very similar with those two. We may ask you for some help with Bowie.
Okay.
I'll put you on alert.
Okay. Well, the gentleman there will end up being someone like me. He's an attorney by trade. He worked in the oil and gas. He retired from Chevron. So he's not going to have, a zillion years of history like Cokie would, but he certainly can probably lead you in the right direction.
Yeah. Again, just like your family, Cokie has kept very good archival material that we try to hopefully protect.
Mm-hmm.
If they have something similar, we'd just like to some...
I find it hard to believe they wouldn't, but you just never know.
I know. Do you ever deal with the engineering firm in New Orleans? I lost it.
Baltimore Nelson.
Yeah, Baltimore Nelson.
Yeah. We've... It's interesting, you mentioned Harvey, because their sulfur mine at Grandikai was serviced from a site on Harvey, because it was the quickest way to move material. to that site. Well, we've been at, provided access to their photo files. It's absolutely incredible.
Who's photo files? Waldemar Nelson?
Waldemar Nelson, yes. And it's,
well, the business they were in, you would think they have incredible records to go back on.
Their archive literally fills a warehouse.
Yeah.
It's just enormous. Yeah.
Well, the most important part of Waldemar Nelson is that in their building is the headquarters of Bacchus, and that's where my wife works. And Greg's a rider.
So. And I'm a rider, yeah.
Well, that's fine.
Huh? Oh, yeah, yeah. What are you telling me? I'm a New Orleans boy. I'm not a girl. Jazz, jazz. Uptown, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, so raised on Fontainebleau Drive.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you give us a date when you talked about this area's declining importance as oil production has moved further and further offshore? Can you point to a date, an approximate date when?
I'd say it's, you know, we had a huge boom in probably the 70s and early 80s. I mean, back in the early 80s, you know, oil jumped up to $30 a barrel, and Jimmy Carter is talking about we've got a shortage of natural gas, and they're putting on a windfall profit tax, and everything was crazy, and you couldn't build buildings big fast enough for people. And then 1985, 86 comes, and the Saudis decide they're going to get hold of control the price of oil, and they drop the price of oil to, I think, as low as $10 a barrel or under. And that was kind of the beginning of the end of the majors being in this area.
The saying on the canal was stay alive till 85.
Yeah.
And it was a chapter 11 in 07.
Yeah.
In 90, you know, so 87.
But McDermott moved out. They got out of all of their properties and systematically sold them off. And the majors started to, you know, their consolidation into downtown and then eventually into Houston. And then you also started to have that, while that's going on, you start to have the supersizing of all of these structures, and the fact that the Harvey Canal could no longer get those structures out of the canal into blue water,
because of the bridge.
The bridges, but the draft. The canal is only 14 feet deep, mm-hmm. So you don't have very much draft there, and so you started to see the big fabricators moving into Port Fouchon and into Houma. You still have the smaller package fabricators here, and you still do. Gentleman I was meeting with was with Chet Morrison. He's got a fabrication yard here. He's got a fabrication yard at Houma. But that was kind of the starting of the change, kind of the really crash of the value of oil, and a multitude of these small service companies basically going bankrupt, and then the larger fabricators starting to move to areas where they could get to blue water without any of the restrictions and constrictions. And so this area started to change. We're still, right now, we're down a little bit, but we're normally running, you know, 85 to 90% occupancy, you know, overall in this area in our warehouses, but it's a lot of different.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What has moved in to fill the void? Well, where the majors moved out?
Yeah, we've got a boat company that sells boats. We've got some fabricators still in this industrial park. We've got a wide variety. We've got a steel company. We've got an oil environmental company that basically takes used oil, collects it, recycles it. We've got, interestingly enough, we've actually had at a couple of different times, we've had movie production companies storing props and things like that in here. We've got a company that's a pretty large printing and embroidery company. So it's a kind of a wide variety. Still got a lot of supply companies, but it's just, you know, it's different. For a while, we had a mulch company operating on. I mean, they take trees and make mulch there.
So
it's, now, it's still for the most part industrial, but it's just.
But it's not oil.
It's not all tied into oil and gas.
Well, you mentioned you owned the east side, and the west side was owned by the Destrehan family.
For the most part, yes.
On both sides.
Yeah.
When did Bollinger move in? Because that's an industry that can survive very well in a 14-foot draft.
Yeah. Bollinger probably has been here for at least 15 years.
Wow.
And they took over, in some respects, some of the facilities they took over were Avondale facilities. Mm-hmm. So they took those facilities over from Avondale because Avondale was getting out of the small ship repair type stuff. Mm-hmm. And they took some of those facilities over.
Well, they've got that repair stuff here right next to 4th Street. But then down just before the canal merges with the Algiers Cut-Off Canal, they've got a big barge manufacturing company down there.
Yeah.
So they've got two things on the canal.
Well, speaking of canal, when was the Louisiana Cypress Lumber or Logging Canal? I don't know how it's based in the maps, built.
Yeah,
the
Lumber Canal.
Lumber Canal. When was that built?
My guess can only be that it was built when we were harvesting this whole area.
All right.
This whole area right in here. You know, we own 50,000 acres, but we probably harvested, who knows, 500,000 acres. So we don't own every acre that we harvested.
Great-grandfather only bought what he had to buy.
Yeah, only when people didn't want to sell just the timber. So, and evidently he had geological ESP to pick out all those great spots with oil and gas, right?
Yeah. I mean, for example, the one down here at Paradis, the Paradis field, we cut all that in the wrong.
Yeah, that was kind of, that's when he did his geological psyche wasn't working as well. But I would guess that it was up in here, so you got to think 1900, somewhere in there, 1910.
Because one of the early maps shows right over in here, and it, of course none of this was here, there is a reference to the Louisiana Cypress Logging Company in here. And I don't remember you ever harvesting in here from my recollections.
Well, it's possible. We actually own the 2,000 acres down here, and we own some more acreage right here. So it's possible that we did do some harvesting in there.
But it's important, because when I see that, I assume you owned it, and that's not what you're saying. You just got the right to cut timber.
Yeah. Yeah. We bought the stumpage.
We bought the timber. That's the majority of
what
we did.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah, we did not. We only owned what we had to own.
I got you. Okay.
And I guess in hindsight, we wish we owned it all, but that's a whole other story.
But you know, there's the other side of that one, Greg.
And that's called paying the taxes and surviving.
It's surviving the Depression.
Right.
You know, and we've all thought we were pretty damn lucky not to own that much property going through the Depression, or we'd have been land poor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You've been pretty rich later, but...
Very interesting.
Well, this map has been a wonderful map to have, and we had another one made in what, 1990?
In Michael Bordelon did that, so that had to be early to mid 80s because he was gone in what, 87?
Oh, was it? Is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But when we rented, we had it actually hung over there, but when we kind of renovated this and made this room smaller to create another office over there, so there was really no place to put it. So it's stored in our warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd like to ask you guys to look forward 25 years.
Well, I'm going to not be here. Cokie may still be here. that is worrisome to me. I mean, we all know what Katrina did. You know, we see Gustav, we see Ike, and it worries me that we are not doing the things we need to do as a state and as a nation to protect our coast and to re-nourish our coast. There was an article in the newspaper last week talking, I don't want to talk too poorly of the Corps since we're on tape here, but talking about how they're still operating under these antiquated principles that when they're doing this dredging, they've got to dispose of it as cheaply as they can possibly dispose of it instead of doing beneficial dredge projects all over the marsh. I mean, it's just, it's insanity. They just spent billions of dollars to recover from Hurricane Katrina, and they're going to worry about pennies to not distribute this soil. And it just worries me. I mean, you know, are we going to be Holland? I'm concerned about where we're going to be 25 years from now. I think the population in New Orleans and Louisiana, we're a resilient group of people. I mean, you're going to have to kill us to get us out of here. But it just worries me that the environmental situations we're dealing with are not being dealt with.
I'm going to interrupt Greg here for a second, because the Corps has this philosophy that it's their job to do everything as cheaply as they can. And I'll give you an example that I just ran through about a year ago. There was an ad in the paper where the Corps wanted a couple of blocks of land, literally blocked. And so I called up the Corps and I got a hold of some lady and I said, are you going to, you know, how are you going to lease this? She said, well, I'm going to go get an appraiser. And I said, oh, we've just run into that one. You go get the cheapest appraiser you can find. She said, well, that's my duty, to try to get the lowest price for the taxpayer. I said, yeah, but the lowest price, sometimes you're wrong on the number, because the appraiser is just giving you the lowest price and he knows it's not right. He said, I don't care. So there's that mentality in the Corps that, like Greg says, that why they're not taking all this muck that they're dredging out and putting it into try to rebuild some of the land, I don't know. Now, they're doing some of that down in
the Lombard. Yes, they are. They're doing some of it, but they could be doing so much more. You know, that's from the environmental point of view. You look at all the other things going on in this state and this area, and I mean, I think it's interesting. We may be finally just starting to crack the nut on all this corruption. And I think if we can finally get a handle on that, you know, I think people will start thinking about it. This is a better place to come and do business. So I think, Katrina was a disaster, but heck, maybe it was also a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to take us years to recover. It's already taken us years, but I'm hopeful that when it's all said and done, we're going to be a better place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One thing is for sure, 57, 25, 82, I'm probably not going to be here.
I don't know the longevity of your employees, man.
Well, I can certainly envision myself being here another 10 years at least. So, I love the Smoky Mountains. I love hiking there. I just love being there, and I want to spend more time there. So at some point, I want to take the Joe Boudreaux role.
Whereabouts?
In the Smoky Mountain area.
Doesn't make any difference.
I actually bought a cabin on a stream in Weirs Valley, which is between Pigeon Forge and Townsend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I just came back from there from Thanksgiving, but.
I was there around last Thanksgiving. It's a beautiful place in the fall.
Yeah. Well, we talked a little bit about Joe Boudreaux. When Joe was going to retire, they didn't want him to retire, so he cut a deal where he stayed on, but he had 8 weeks of vacation, and he only worked Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and it worked out. He did that for about two extra years, I think. Yeah. He stayed on a couple more years just to kind of a transition from him to me, and then he finally did retire up in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Keep joking with him. I want the Joe Boudreaux spot.
Yeah. Well, I get it first.
Well, with the longevity of some of your employees, the oil companies found out that there's nothing better than the longevity of their senior employees. And when they got rid of them in the 1980s, they suddenly realized they had no corporate memory.
Yeah.
You clearly have corporate memory. Mm-hmm. It's not insignificant.
Yeah, because corporate memory and stability often go hand in hand.
Oh, yeah.
And when you have people that have been here for so long, they just know things out there that Unless you walk it, you don't know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, which is why we're here today to record this. Yeah. Because you're able to put all of these pieces of the mosaic together into something that makes sense, not only for yourselves, but for someone coming in cold from the outside.
Yeah.
So what you've done today is, you know,
what we're looking at, we've not formally introduced Roy. Roy, tell him your title.
The title is...
Besides photographer.
the title is Director of Outreach and Communication for at Louisiana Sea Grant, which is at LSU.
That's in Baton Rouge.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And what we're doing is we're collecting stories and visuals, and we want to put them into museum quality and have kiosks. Right now, we think the first kiosk will be on shrimp drying. And Koki has mentioned that their boat driver, who we need to interview
Tim, sure.
Yeah.
Probably can tell us more than we can find any other way.
He can bring it all the trip drying places out on the Gulf. I mean, he can...
Well, you can see we're starting to get themes.
Right.
And the logging business is an important theme.
And the oil industry will be another, and cattle industry, and all of us trapping, everything that has formed part of that mosaic.
Yeah. I think it's great.
And what we'd like to do is... we haven't finished copying all of your things, so we'll have to come back and maybe set up another interview, because you'll get a chance to think.
Okay.
There may be important issues you'd like to bring up.
You know, that we may have completely overlooked today, you know, that we may not realize is absolutely fundamental to what's going on.
Well, you know, one thing that maybe in your studies that too often I think that the landowners... And the oil companies are blamed for the the degradation of the land. When I think that our timber cruise in 1903 kind of tells you that everybody might be contributing, but Mother Nature is the one who's been running it for a long time and will continue to control it. Because people don't have a clue that that's really what was happening.
Yeah. You know, bottom line is it was going to happen anyway. This just, we sped did up. Some things that sped the process up.
Yeah.
We didn't do it on purpose. We just didn't know.
Well, I think that's the important story, and Carl and I both feel that way, that things happen because they happened.
Yeah.
You mentioned your 1903 timber cruise. What, is that a paper document?
Yeah.
It was a letter.
Mm-hmm.
It was a letter. We were involved in a massive lawsuit that I really can't discuss too much because of confidentiality and settlement issues and those type of things. But I would call almost a historic document search for things.
Well,
we found that.
Yeah. Well, if we could have a copy of that to digitize, because that bit of evidence is huge.
Yeah. Do you remember where that was and what we did with it?
It's in one of our scrapbooks.
Okay.
All right.
We may have already.
We, quite frankly, you have so much. We're sort of like robots when we do this.
Yeah, just copy.
There's four
we'll figure it out later.
We each operate two computers at a time.
Yeah.
So we have four computers, four scanners going continuously when we're here. As Don said, it's like being hit by a tsunami.
You're copying. You'll figure it out all later.
But truly, you know, we've been at this for about 2 hours, and that's, I think, a nice time frame. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you both for your time.
Pleasure to help you.
And if you think of additional things, Carl and I will come back, but we do have other things we're doing, so maybe a while. And when we come back, we'll bring you a copy.
Okay.
And you'll be able to have it for your own phone. And just if you think of things, let us know.
Okay.
Because that's what we've been doing. With every trip, we've always given you a copy, a digital copy of everything we've digitized.
Okay.
Well, I'll see if we can come up with that. If I get some time, I'll go in that file and look. But I was flabbergasted when I read it.
Yeah, it was like, gee, that's amazing. I would think about, at some point, maybe talking to Alice Landry, because I think she would have a wealth of information going, because her dad was Ambrose Landry and kind of that whole thing. I know she knows a lot of that because we've talked about it before when we're sitting down over ducks eating. You know.
Wait a minute. What's the name again?
Alice Landry, but she's a Champagne now. She's married to our sheriff. And she was Ambrose Landry's daughter.
Shoot, I taught her. I taught her in Thibodeau.
You probably did. She went to Thibodeau.
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Well, there you go. Were you nice to her?
Oh, the Landrys. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Mr. Ambrose, this is an aside. Mr. Ambrose came up to me one day and he said, I want to make you an honorary Kunas. And he has this little certificate signed.
Yeah.
And he made my dad and mother. And my dad and mother had that on their wall until they both passed.
Yeah.
And I have it tucked away. It's one of those moments that I felt I have been accepted. Yeah.
Where are you from?
I'm from California.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, but my master's and PhD are from LSU. And I taught at Nichols for 17 years before I came back to LSU.
Okay.
But while we're just chatting, you know, there's the community of cousins. There's the community of Frenier. There's one more over there that was a logging community. I've actually seen one referred to as the Rathburn community. And I think it was just, it's a regional name.
Okay.
That maybe what is just a regional identifier. Those little communities are important to the story because you had to have a crew. They had to live somewhere, usually a quarter boat. They had to work. We talk about 7 and 7, it was 7 and 2, because you would go out and work the swamp. That's how you make a living. Those communities are very important to the kinds of things we're trying to get to, and you have some superb photography. So if you think of that, I mean, I've actually been told, I have a reference that Fats Domino was born in Frenier, yet his own biographer doesn't say that's true, and I know I'm not making it up. But sometimes you become so connected to a city that you forget that's not where you were born.
Right.
And this was a logging community. Yeah. And those are the kinds of things, if you can put in the back of your brain, give us until January or so, through the Christmas holidays.
But guys, honestly, thank you so much for your time. You're
welcome.
It's been fun.
For us too.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I enjoy maps. I enjoy history. So this is all
fun
stuff.
And Greg will help you with Bowie.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. Okay. All right. But you're looking at two map fanatics here, historical maps.
Yeah. Next time, maybe we'll bring a few with us and let you look at them.
Okay.
You might find them intriguing.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, I think we can arrange to find a few things that you might find
interesting. Okay. We'll do it. Good.
I'd be happy to do it.
Okay.
We're good.
It's been a good day.
Safe and
easy. Safe and easy.
You know, this is what, when you look at this thing, Leslie LeVere and